Chapter 3. Politics and Identity. Peter Cook said in Beyond the Fringe, "Yes, I could have been a judge, but I never had the Latin. Never had the Latin for the judging. I just never had sufficient of it to get through the rigorous judging exam. They're noted for their rigor. People come staggering out saying, 'My God, what a rigorous exam!' And so I became a minor." The most important postmodernist ethical argument concerns the relationship between discourse and power. A discourse here means a historically evolved set of interlocking and mutually supporting statements, which are used to define and describe a subject matter. Crudely, it's the language of the main intellectual disciplines, for example, the discursive practices of law, medicine, aesthetic judgment, and so on. These discourses, as used by lawyers, doctors, and others, do not just implicitly accept some kind of dominating theory to guide them, for example, in the guise of a paradigm as used by those engaged in orthodox science. They involve politically contentious activities, not just because of the certainty with which they describe and define people, who is an immigrant or an asylum seeker or a criminal or mad or a terrorist, but because such discourses at the same time express the political authority of their users. Prisoner: "As God is my judge, my lord, I am not guilty." Judge: "He is not. I am. You are. 6 months." The power of words. All reasonably systematic uses of language are to be seen as having a particular power-enforcing function. You believe what the young surgeon tells you, and so give him permission to anesthetize you, cut you up, and help you recover. The language game of the discourse expresses and enacts the authority of those who are empowered to use it within a social group, which includes hospitals, law courts, boards of examiners, and professors like me writing books like this. It can also be used to subordinate or exclude or marginalize those who are outside it. Witches, mesmerists, faith healers, homosexuals, communist sympathizers, anarchist protesters. Here is one of the many connections with the philosophical themes explored earlier. The most influential analysis of this relationship between discourse and power was given by Michel Foucault in his studies of the history of practices in law, penology, and medicine. Such powerful discourses are rather obviously designed to exclude and control people, such as those diagnosed as criminally insane or ill. And these exclusions arise for Foucault in a classically Marxist manner. He wrote in Discipline and Punish, The Birth of the Prison, in 1977, "The general juridical form that guaranteed a system of rights that were egalitarian in principle was unsupported by these fine, everyday physical mechanisms, by all those systems of micropower that are essentially non-egalitarian and asymmetrical that we call the disciplines, such as exams, hospitals, prisons, the regulation of workshops, schools, the army." Foucault adopts the victim's position and analyzes power from the bottom up, and not simply as an imposition of the interests of the class above. He tries to show that the will to exercise power beats humanitarian egalitarianism every time, and implies that even the Enlightenment reliance upon universal principle and reason is always incipiently totalitarian, because the appeal to an always correct reason is itself a system of control, and will always exclude what it makes marginal, simply by seeing it as non-rational. For Foucault, these supposed irrationalities would include matters of desire, feeling, sexuality, femininity, and art. Foucault is deeply anti-progressive. He is an anti-Whig historian who chronicles the rise of unfreedom. In doing this, he looks for what he calls the episteme, that is, the largely unconscious assumptions concerning intellectual order that underlie the historical states of particular societies. These are the historical a priori conditions of a period, which delimit the totality of experience in a field of knowledge, define the mode of being of the objects in the field, and provide man's everyday perceptions with theoretical powers. They also define the conditions under which a discourse can be true. We need to dig for this in history, hence what Foucault calls the archaeology of the episteme. These conditions lie below perception. They are not always explicit, so that the episteme is a kind of epistemological unconscious for an age. Foucault subjects all this material to a leftist critique to show what and whom it excludes and how. Power and knowledge fundamentally interact, for example, when the medically trained reasonable people define themselves against the unreasonable, and having made their judgment, proceed to lock them up in asylums. Sexists, racists, and imperialists all use similar techniques. They make their normalizing discourse prevail, and in doing so, they can actually create or bring into being the deviant, or what many postmodernists call, the other. Their discourse actually helps to create the subordinate identities of those who are excluded from participation in it. Foucault takes homosexuals, women, the criminally insane, non-whites, and prisoners as standard examples of the other. This opposition and antipathy is really quite obvious in schools, armies, and in the process of imperial rule. And so postmodernist thought has inspired much work on the nature of the post-colonial subject. What is distinctive here of postmodernism is the basis of the analysis in the linguistic, as we have already seen in looking at Derrida and Barthes. People become signs, part of the play of language. Hence, for example, Laura Mulvey's much-cited and frequently reprinted Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema in Screen 16, Number 3, from Autumn 1975, which includes the magnificently overconfident generalization that woman then stands in patriarchal culture as a signifier for the male other, bound by a symbolic order in which man can live out his fantasies and obsessions through linguistic command by imposing them on the silent image of a woman still tied to her place as a bearer of meaning, not maker of meaning. We thus talk people into being, just as we do universities and the euro. But the postmodernists go on from this to make an important, more general point. Discourse, from this point of view, is like a Derridean language. It isn't the property of controlling individuals. It goes beyond them. Nor is it only to be found in obviously formal contexts, like that of the law court. It is out and about in society from top to bottom, from the pronouncements of judges to scientific journals to TV advertisement, pop songs, and the broadsheets of the day. And the more dominant a discourse is within a group or society, the more natural it can seem, and the more it tends to appeal to the ways of nature to justify itself. Nature as a whole may seem to proclaim the ordering powers of a god, or the hidden order discovered by scientists, or to contain breeds beyond the pale, or women or the mad, who are to be thought of as inherently, that is, naturally, more animal, less reasonable than us, and so on. We internalize these subordinating norms, which, as Derrida and Foucault point out, are often intimately part of our language, without always realizing that this is what they are. We go along with them unwittingly, as if they were facts about nature, rather than psychologically and politically motivated features of our talk about it. The asylum, for example, as described by Foucault, is driven by the discourse of the doctor, and mirrors the authoritarian structures of the bourgeois society which surrounds it. It is a microcosm for family, transgression, and madness relations. Foucault, on the other hand, or rather on the left, is in favor of folly and against bourgeois reason, and although his history of asylums is not nearly as empirically well-founded as it ought to be, the political point he wished to make about authority and power went home. Like so many in the 1960s, such as the analyst R.D. Lang in his The Divided Self, or Ken Kesey in his novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Foucault casts the insane in the role of society's victims and stresses society's failure to see that the insane are also deeply unhappy individuals. He makes a similar analysis and a similar overgeneralization about prisons, which supposedly reveal the basic carceral nature of the society around them. Society, in Foucault's Kafkaesque rewrite of Orwell's 1984, suffers from a universal panopticism. We are all being secretly surveyed and controlled. But this is to pretend that the usual forms of social control, like working to a routine and being supervised, are the same thing as being in prison. But society and prison are not the same. I have given above some obvious examples of the abuse of power. These offend our Enlightenment intuitions about universal justice and the right of the individual to autonomy. But it is one of Foucault's many defects that he fails to give anything like an ethical account of power in general. He wants struggle rather than submission, but he doesn't very clearly say why. For him, power seems to be a kind of electrical force, an inevitable accompaniment to all human activity, like gravity. Although his thought presupposes a leftist, indeed Marxist, analysis, he avoids any obvious political commentaries and moral theories. And so, in the end, although he is a classical resister, he does little more than recommend, rather as Lyotard does, small-scale local reforms. As Terry Eagleton puts it in The Illusions of Postmodernism from 1996, Foucault objects to particular regimes of power not on moral grounds, but simply on the grounds that they are regimes as such, and so, from some vague libertarian standpoint, repressive. Just as importantly, in looking at the functions of discourse, Foucault fails to allow for the ways in which it actually works through individuals, and so he underestimates the importance of individual agency and responsibility. We all know we should distrust Angelo in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure when he says to Isabella, "It is the law, not I, condemns your brother." For Foucauldians, it is not so much the individual who does dreadful things as the discourse of power that flows through him or her. Foucault thus provides a sophisticated, language-based version of the class antagonisms of Marx. He relies on beliefs about the inherent evil of the individual's class position or professional position seen as discourse, regardless of the morality of his or her individual conduct. Readers of this book will have hardly failed to notice the unwillingness of politicians to accept individual responsibility for their actions, or even for that of their subordinates, as they used to do. They also tend to express wildly prejudiced views, on the grounds that they are held by large numbers of people, perhaps recent immigrants or those seeking asylum, or neighbors of a different ethnic group, and in doing so, say that they are merely to be seen as articulating those views as of political importance. In all such cases, they just allow discourse to wash through them. And when their conduct has been questionable, they do not simply say, "I did not do it," or "I did do it," but rather claim to have been exonerated or excused by the discourse of the report that has been made upon their actions. To that extent, they indeed demonstrate the Foucauldian episteme of their age, and with that, the disadvantages of an inherently politicizing rather than a moral view of individual responsibility. Self and identity. The analysis of the relation between discourse and power had a further and important consequence for postmodernists. It led to a distinctive view of the nature of the self, which was a challenge to the individualist rationalism and the emphasis on personal autonomy of most liberals. Indeed, the term preferred by postmodernists to apply to individuals is not so much self as subject, because the latter term implicitly draws attention to the subjected condition of persons who are, whether they know it or not, controlled, if you are on the left, or constituted, if you are in the middle, by the ideologically motivated discourses of power which predominate in the society they inhabit. The extraordinary achievement of Foucault and those who thought like him was, given their analysis of the workings of power, to go on to make one of the most influential of postmodernist claims, the claim that such discourses entailed, imposed, demanded, the many possibilities here constitute the interest of the claim, a particular kind of identity for all those who were affected by them. In postmodernist jargon, they constitute the subject. Of course, the fact that institutions and their discourses demand that you be a particular sort of person to fit in was hardly unknown. Anyone who has been in a school or sports team or military organization or given birth to a baby in a hospital, let alone read some of the organization man sociology of the 1950s, is to some degree aware of this point. But the postmodernist argument was an exceptionally subtle one. We don't just play roles in such cases, but our very identity, the notion we have of ourselves, is at issue when we are affected by discourses of power. These, of course, run from those which are directly concerned with matters of identity, in religion and in therapy, from Freudianism to psychobabble, to those which are far less obviously so, as in the case of a woman responding to the female lead in a male-dominated Hollywood film, or to paintings of the nude in the male-dominated museum, or the teenager in front of the TV set. All discourses put you in your place. I am, as usual, citing examples that are more everyday and intuitively appealing than the rather heavily buried and theorized examples to be found in the abounding academic literature of postmodernism. Postmodernist critics go on to make political claims concerning the nature of the subject. One of these is that the conflicting languages of power which circulate through and within individuals actually constitute the self. The subject cannot, on this view, ever stand aside from actual social conditions and judge them from a rational, autonomous point of view, as moral philosophers in the Anglo-American Kantian tradition, like John Rawls and Thomas Nagel, argue. The thoughts and expressions of the male individual, for example, are seen as part of a pattern of contaminated, patriarchal discourses, which are in any case in conflict, and of which he is the mere epiphenomenon. This chucks out the Kantian unifying ego in favor of a postmodernist updating of the Freudian model, of persons as undergoing an internal conflict between systems. As Sayla Benhabib, a professor of government at Harvard University, puts it, conflating as she does so Derridean and Foucauldian language about language, she writes in Situating the Self from 1992, the subject is replaced by a system of structures, oppositions, and differences, which, to be intelligible, need not be viewed as products of a living subjectivity at all. You and I are the mere sites of such conflicting languages of power, and the self is merely another position in language. The consequences of this view of the nature of the individual can be very clearly seen in many postmodernist literary texts, which contrast in this respect with the liberal tradition of the novel as continued in this period by writers like Angus Wilson, Iris Murdoch, John Updike, Philip Roth, and Saul Bellow. For a literary critic and historian of postmodernism like Linda Hutchin, such novels as Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children challenge the humanist assumption of a unified self and an integrated consciousness. Postmodernist fiction, she writes in A Poetics of Postmodernism from 1988, puts into question that entire series of interconnected concepts that have come to be associated with what we conveniently label as liberal humanism: autonomy, transcendence, certainty, authority, unity, totalization, system, universalization, center, continuity, teleology, closure, hierarchy, homogeneity, uniqueness, origin. And so, in much recent American fiction, Peter Curry writes in Eccentric Selves from Contemporary American Fiction from 1987, the focus of attention has shifted from the psychology of character, an irreducible essence, something human, to the inadequacy of the concept of character, to a recognition of subjectivity as the trace of plural and intersecting discourses, of non-unified, contradictory ideologies, the product of a relational system which is finally that of discourse itself. A classic and influential instance is the title story of John Barth's Lost in the Funhouse from 1968, in which the narrator, Ambrose, describes the difficulty of writing a story called Lost in the Funhouse about a character called Ambrose who is lost in the funhouse. He is supposed to be visiting Ocean City with his family sometime during the last war, part of which involves going to a funhouse. But he is described by an author who is perpetually aware of the fact that he is telling a story, that he is using literary conventions to do so. So far, he says, there's been no real dialogue, very little sensory detail, and nothing in the way of a theme. And Ambrose is just a function of his author's story, so that one possible ending would be to have Ambrose come across another lost person in the dark. We are perpetually deprived of any illusion of Ambrose's autonomy in favor of our seeing him, truthfully enough, as the creature of the person who is writing him, who also acts like a stereotypical author who, as his remarks about the function of italics or the lack of a climax in his own story imply, seems to be trying to apply the correct rules for narrative which he has learned in writing school. What goes for a character in a novel goes for authors. They, too, are spoken by the language they give speech to, that of the writing school, for example. And it goes, too, for the reader, who is in no better case than the author, also being dispersed among the interstices of language, enmeshed with and finally lost among the endless relay of signification. So writes Catherine Belsley in Critical Practice from 1980. She goes on to say, a human being, on this view, is not a unity, not autonomous, but a process, is perpetually in construction, perpetually contradictory, perpetually open to change. The postmodernist notion of human identity as essentially constructed like a fiction is also to be found in the visual arts, as is to be seen in Cindy Sherman's series of photographs, Untitled Film Stills, taken from 1977 to 1980, and its successors. In each of these, Sherman impersonates film actresses, disguising herself more or less in different clothing and in different implied situations which are typical or stereotypical in film. In the process, we see her adapting the discourses of film to present herself in a photographic still as all sorts of different people, but all, often satirical or parodic, versions of femininity are seen in the discourses of a mass medium. Of course, this is just another version of acting, but the photographs are not based on any particular film, and they rather schematically raise questions about the ways in which Sherman can preserve or not preserve an underlying identity in all these different roles. In so doing, they also put into question the notion of the real Cindy Sherman. Which photographs could possibly convince us that we are seeing this? An open, sincere, emotional, or even naked one? But each of these would be just the result of another convention, another discourse. For Roland Barthes, the ideal postmodernist work of art recognizes these strategies and playful limitations on human identity and discourse, precisely because this play and division has desirable moral consequences. It disposes of precisely that Kantian unity of the person which makes for social order and moral orthodoxy. He writes in The Pleasure of the Text from 1975, the pleasure of the text does not prefer one ideology to another. However, this impertinence does not proceed from liberalism, but from perversion. The text, its reading, are split. What is overcome, split, is the moral unity that society demands of every human product. Barthes exemplifies his own remarkably evasive doctrine in his autobiographical works, notably through the novelistic conception of himself in A Lover's Discourse from 1977, in which the grammar of French in the original adroitly keeps the sexual orientation of the protagonist ambiguous, as does the language of Auden's love poetry. And Roland Barthes by Roland Barthes from 1975, an autobiography, begins by announcing in an epigraph that all of this must be thought of as being said by a character in a novel. Tout ceci doit être considéré comme dit par un personnage de roman. So there are two voices in the book, Barthes' own, or that of the author, which we might infer, and that of Barthes as a fictional character. Barthes also reviewed his own book, this time with a reviewer persona. Such deconstructions of the moral unity of the subject and the classically liberal desire to help the self to evade some of the repressive ideological boundaries it encounters are very different things. Indeed, the justification for our desire to evade or redraw such boundaries, such as those which confer sexual identity, already depends on a notion of the new moral unity or integrity or autonomy we can achieve once the restrictive boundary is removed. This becomes obvious when, for example, we are urged to recognize the different but non-fractured identities of the homosexual and the heterosexual, or of male and female, by refusing to fall into the ideological trap analyzed by Derrida of seeing the one as an inferior version of the other. What postmodern theory helps us to see is that we are all constituted in a broad range of subject positions, through which we move with more or less ease, so that all of us are combinations of class, race, ethnic, regional, generational, sexual, and gender positions. Many postmodernists make this rather pessimistic analysis in the hope of liberating us from it. Once we have been made aware of the dire effects of contradictory discourses upon us, We are expected to be able to find some kind of way out. The politics of difference. Postmodernists may not give a particularly convincing account of the nature of the self as it might appear in a moral philosophy concerned with responsibility, but they do very successfully adapt Foucauldian arguments to show the ways in which discourses of power are used in all societies to marginalize subordinate groups. For such discourses of power do not just contribute to the decentering and deconstruction of the self, they also serve to marginalize those people who do not partake in them. Again, there are plenty of these eccentric marginalized figures to be encountered within postmodernist fiction, such as Colehouse Walker in Doctorow's Ragtime, Fevers in Angela Carter's Nights at the Circus, and Salim Sinai in Rushdie's Midnight's Children. Salim is not of any great social importance, and yet his crisis of identity, along with his magical telepathic relationship to those who were also born at the moment of India's independence, is metaphorically seen as parallel to the crisis of the nation as a whole. He indeed tells us, "I was linked to history both literally and metaphorically, both actively and passively." But the political history of India is deconstructed to show that the marginal can be seen as the central. Indeed, Sinai is diffused, like the reader following his text, into all sorts of surrounding fragmentary narratives. The novel does not try to make any sense of the emotional logic of an individual's life, as is typical of realist fiction, but uses its magic realist techniques to show the self as constituted by the conflicts and contradictions of the historical event, to the point of an absurdist hyperbole, as when Salim remarks, "Nehru's death, too, was all my fault." Even his face is the whole map of India, but by the end of the novel, he is no more than a big-headed, top-heavy dwarf. The novel owes a great deal to Gunter Grass's The Tin Drum. Postmodernist thought, in attacking the idea of a notional center or dominant ideology, facilitated the promotion of a politics of difference. Under postmodern conditions, the ordered class politics preferred by socialists has given way to a far more diffuse and pluralistic identity politics, which often involves the self-conscious assertion of a marginalized identity against the dominant discourse. An example of this, which is undoubtedly central to the politics of the period since the late 1960s, is the relationship between postmodernism and feminism. The argument here is that women are excluded from the patriarchal symbolic order or from the dominant male discourse, and indeed that they have been defined or othered as inferior with respect to it. They are subjected to a Derridean false hierarchy by being assigned weak values, opposite to the strong ones invested in masculinity. We saw a bit of this in looking at the egg and sperm controversy. Much feminist thought therefore has in common with postmodernism that it attacks the legitimating meta-discourse used by males, designed to keep them in power, and it seeks an individual empowerment against this. But I agree with critics of this position, like Ben Habib, that the woman who does this shouldn't be seen as occupying merely another position in language. For the postmodernist view of this socially constructed self ignores the way the self is constituted by an individual's maintenance of an original, often idiosyncratic, narrative of him or herself. This is the key to creativity in the individual. This evidence for the growth of an individual through the socialization process is neglected by social construction theorists of the self. We can, of course, discern the conventional codes and the allegiances to socially constructed kinds of discourse in anyone's autobiography, but with respect to our own, we are, like Roland Barthes, author and character at once. That is how, although we are made up of heteronymous codes, we can still strive for an autonomy of a classically liberal kind. This sense of autonomy is particularly needed by women, says Ben Habib, whose conclusion is that the strong constructivist positions derived from Derrida and Foucault would actually undermine the theoretical articulation of the emancipatory aspirations of women. In undermining women's sense of their own agency and sense of selfhood, they deny any reappropriation of women's own history and the possibility of a radical social criticism. But then the incompatibility of postmodernist attitudes to a commitment to any settled philosophical position, which a good Derridian would then deconstruct, is a grave problem for them. It may indeed be better to follow a rationalist, enlightenment, egalitarian project of progressive emancipation, as opposed to a postmodernist route, which so often ends up in a radical separatism. For although postmodernist arguments have helped many to define the roots of their difference from the majority or those in power, effective political action needs something more than this rather preliminary sense of a dissentient identity. The liberal would join with the postmodernist in seeing the need for an ability to question the boundaries of our social roles and the validity and dominance of the conceptual frameworks they presuppose. And the postmodernist deconstructive attitude has been extraordinarily effective in combating restrictive ideologies in this way. They often attempt a transgressive deconstructive loosening of the conceptual boundaries of our thoughts about gender, race, sexual orientation, and ethnicity, and make an essentially liberal demand for the recognition of difference, an acceptance of the other within the community. In such a pluralistic universe of discourse, no one framework is likely to gain assent. Where epistemological domination is deemed to be impossible, the competition between these conceptual frameworks becomes a political matter, part of a contest for power. The postmodernist self, then, is very differently conceived from the self at the center of liberal humanist thought, which is supposed to be capable of being autonomous, rational, and centered, and somehow free of any particular cultural, ethnic, or gendered characteristics. Postmodernist analysis has turned away from such optimistically universalizable Kantian assumptions to see the self as constituted by language systems, which, although they may most obviously dominate the proletarian, the female, the black, and the colonized, have us all more or less in their grip. This general move from a liberal emphasis on self-determination to a Marx-inspired emphasis on other determination is of immense importance. It is a sharp challenge to established post-Enlightenment Anglo-American philosophical views, and it points to the irreconcilable differences of identity between individuals. As Robert Hughes has put it in his The Culture of Complaint, and admittedly very polemically, it has created a culture in which many were encouraged to see themselves as victims. We will look more closely at this culture in the next section. The result is that although much postmodernist thinking and writing and visual art can be seen as attacking stereotypical categories, defending difference, and so on, it left all these separate groupings to demand recognition as authentic but isolated communities, once they were freed, in and by theory, from the dominant categories of the majority. The beneficiaries of this analysis were both separatist, alienated from and resenting orthodoxy, and partially communitarian, as they identified with others who had similarly defined a dissenting identity. But then how could such differentially defined groups, the result of a categorical freeing up, communicate back with any actually existent political center? This was difficult, given the sustained and near-anarchist hostility of many postmodernists to any overall theory or picture of society. It is a paradoxical result. A left-inspired distrust of authority, of the Lyotardian kind, makes recognition of difference possible, and yet those who are perhaps most in favor of leaving differently defined groups in isolation to compete and fight it out are those on the right, who believe in individual freedom with the minimum amount of state restraint. One of the problems that a critical postmodernism gets itself into, therefore, is that of specifying, independent of grand narratives, or of a lapse back to Kantian or essentializing Enlightenment ideas, the kind of community that would be desirable once its critique had been made. For the utopian Marxist, the fact that no such model of community was immediately available didn't much matter. But for thinkers with more short-term, this-worldly aims, it does. The oppositional character of postmodernist thought was therefore maintained, but often at too great a cost. For once all these differences and different identities were established, they were cut off from any central harmonizing ideology. Postmodernists therefore seem to call for an irreducible pluralism, cut off from any unifying frameworks of belief that might lead to common political action, and are perpetually suspicious of domination by others. In this, they have turned against those Enlightenment ideals that underlie the legal structures of most Western democratic societies, and that aimed at universalizable ideals of equality and justice. Indeed, postmodernists tend to argue that Enlightenment reason, which claimed to extend its moral ideals to all in liberty, equality, and fraternity, was really a system of repressive Foucauldian control, and that reason itself, particularly in its alliance with science and technology, is incipiently totalitarian. This attack on rationality by postmodernists is to some degree comprehensible, insofar as it expressed a Weberian suspicion of the means-end rationalism of technocratic consumer societies and of capitalist modernization. But postmodernist skepticism was also directed to the very means of rational communication itself. Jürgen Habermas, one of the most eloquent of leftist critics, is not alone in pointing out that it is very dangerous indeed to take the postmodernist turn and abandon the ideal of communicative or indeed consensual rationality, which he sees as the best antidote to the political abuse of power. He thinks that we should aim at an ideal speech situation, a means of communication which is so far as is possible undistorted by Foucauldian effects of power, and at just that consensus and sense of social solidarity of which postmodernists are so mistrustful. For many, the postmodernist position is a disabling one. Postmodernists are just epistemological pluralists with no firm general position available to them, and so, however radical they may seem as critics, they lack a settled external viewpoint, and this means that so far as real-life ongoing politics is concerned, they are passively conservative in effect.